This is John Scheck for Progressive Spirit. On today's show, I feature two guests who are revolutionizing the way we look at leadership and economics. Linda Kohanov is the author of The Five Roles of the Master Herder, a revolutionary model for socially intelligent leadership.
When you have this phenomenon of what I call the master herder, it's a term I use to describe a strong, compassionate, well-balanced leader who also acts as a caretaker and a guardian.
Anthony Flaccavento is the author of Building a Healthy Economy from the Bottom Up, harnessing real-world experience for transformative change. He hopes to take those principles to Washington as he's running for Congress in Southwest Virginia as a rural progressive.
Together, we've fantasized about the notion, if we all win, of forming a rural progressive caucus in Congress to start changing the language and the game a little bit.
It's time for Progressive Spirit. Stay with us. You're listening to the podcast version of Progressive Spirit. If you enjoy the show, please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Podomatic, TuneIn, or whatever podcast app you use to listen, and give Progressive Spirit 5 stars, won't you? Contact me through progressivespirit.net with your thoughts and ideas about the show, and be sure to share this podcast on your social media. Follow on Facebook and Twitter. The website, again, is progressivespirit.net. For the Pacifica Radio Network and the Public Radio Exchange, and from the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, this is Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. I'm John Scheck. Anthony Flaccavento was my first guest ever on this show when it was called Religion for Life. I had him on again last year when we discussed his book, Building a Healthy Economy from the Bottom Up, Harnessing Real-World Experience for Transformative Change. He hopes to make transformative change in Washington as he's now running for Congress in Virginia's 9th District, which encompasses Southwest Virginia. Linda Kohanov lives in Armado, Arizona. She's the author of The Power of the Herd, The Tao of Equus, and the book we are going to discuss today, The Five Roles of the Master Herder, a revolutionary model for socially intelligent leadership. I'll speak with Linda in the second half of the show. Anthony Flaccavento has been a farmer, entrepreneur, and consultant for over 30 years in Southwest Virginia. He's on the leading edge of building sustainable economies and communities, and he hopes to bring this vision to Washington. From Abingdon, Virginia, welcome back, Anthony, to Progressive Spirit.
So glad to be on your show again, John.
Economies based on corporate interests to economies that grow from the bottom up seems to be perhaps the focus of what you're doing. And on your website, bottomupeconomy.org, you write, quote, "Most fundamentally of all, these emerging economies and energized communities are beginning to ask not how are we going to create jobs, but what's the work that needs to be done?" And really fundamental questions you're asking. Can you describe your vision in 2 or 3 minutes for a bottom-up economy?
Sure, I'll try to do that. Thanks, John. So first of all, I chose the term bottom-up. I've been fooling around with trying to create economic alternatives that work better for people and the environment for quite a few years. And I've called it a lot of different things, sustainable development, place-based development, all of which are fair enough. But fundamentally, I wanted a stark contrast with the idea of trickle-down economics, and that's how I have sort of landed on the idea of bottom-up. It's both a good literal description of the difference as well as a good metaphor. So there's two basic problems with the way we go about building economies now and measuring them. One is that the absolute driver in all things is economic growth. An expanded, ever larger economy. You'll hear Democrats and Republicans both agree that that's what we should have, is growth, growth, growth. Well, the first problem with growth is that it absolutely does not necessarily deliver prosperity. I've been doing a little presentation with Rotary and Kiwanis and other folks for the last little bit, and the first two graphs I show them are about the difference between how much our population has grown over the last 40 years and how much our economy has grown. And what's amazing is that even though the total size of the U.S. population has only grown modestly, about 40% in those 40 years, the economy has grown almost threefold. That is to say, it's nearly three times as big. That's three times as much business activity, three times as much cash and credit changing hands, three times as much money being made, and yet the vast majority of people are not better off. So if growth was the answer and the economy is growing six or seven times as fast as the population, then we should be dramatically better off. But as you know, we're not. Most people are treading water or going backwards. So first of all, growth doesn't deliver prosperity, even in the most limited sense of the word. Secondly, a lot of what counts as economic growth is actually cleaning up our messes. It's fixing environmental problems. It's cleaning up toxic spills, oil spills, whether it's the Exxon Valdez or BP in the Gulf. It's fixing problems with human health, like miners who have black lung, or people struggling with drug addiction or obesity. So many of the things that are clearly bad for us, bad for people, bad for the landscape, bad for community, actually contribute to that GDP, that economic growth. So it's absolutely without question that we need a new way of thinking about what a healthy economy is, how we create it, and then how we measure it. Because right now it's too based on one thing, which is if the GDP is growing, we must be doing okay, and it just isn't so.
You mentioned that we're not really benefiting from the economic growth model, except for those perhaps in Donald Trump's economic category.
Right. So if the economy's grown six and a half, seven times faster than the population, that money's gone somewhere, and we know where it's gone. It's gone to the top 0.1%, and to some degree to the top 1 to 10% have also benefited. But the vast majority of Americans, not just the poor, not just the working poor, not just the lower middle class, but even the middle class, are not better off in any real way from this 40 years of trickle-down economics. But other folks, a small group at the top, have gotten spectacularly rich. So the money's gone somewhere for sure.
Speaking with Anthony Flacavento, you've spent a lot of time in farmers markets over the years. What do farmers markets do for communities, and what's keeping them from scaling up to be a real force of opposition to corporate factory-produced food?
Yeah, so farmers markets, I helped to start the market in Abingdon, which has become a great little market, and have worked with farmers markets both in Southwest Virginia, but also other parts of the country a fair bit as part of my consulting work. And, I would argue on the one hand that they have scaled up, just perhaps not as much as we want. Back in 1995, so about a little more than 20 years ago, there was 1,750 farmers markets in the United States, 1,750. Today, there are well over 8,000, pushing 8,500. So the sheer number of them means a lot more farmers markets in a lot more towns and cities, creating a lot more exchange of goods, of farm products and other goods between the producers and consumers. So on the one hand, you could say they've grown quite a bit. I would also say another benefit of farmers markets is that they've helped create connections between people. Farmers markets are, in some respects, the most recent version of public gathering spaces, civic spaces. You know, in Italy and France, you have the piazza, you have the town square where people come together. We don't have much of that in most of the U.S., but farmers markets are one example of where people of all stripes, from the libertarian to the lefty, gather because they're drawn in by wonderful quality food and other items. So I think farmers markets have both created a pretty good opportunity for commerce and at the same time really are helping with downtown revitalization, with rekindling some sense of community and civic culture. That said, for all their benefits, it's also true that a lot of farmers markets kind of hit a plateau. They grow for a number of years. The number of producers and vendors increases, as does the number of customers, and then they kind of hit a flat spot. And one of the challenges I face in working with farmers markets is how to overcome that. But one thing that's clear is that we live in a culture that thinks a lot about the price of products, but also convenience. And even though farmers markets have become more convenient by being more numerous, they're not nearly as convenient as a as a supermarket or a Walmart that's open 24/7 or 18 hours a day, 7 days a week. So it seems like at some point we really run into that problem of people who are driven by the desire or the need for convenience. A lot of people are incredibly busy trying to, you know, maintain their lives, their jobs, their kids. And so the idea of remembering Saturday morning or Tuesday evening or whatever it is at the farmer's market is just difficult for them to get into the habit.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Anthony Flaccovento. Anthony's running for Congress in the 9th District of Virginia, which comprises Southwest Virginia. And yours is a David and Goliath story in some respects. You tried in 2012 to unseat the incumbent. You received 39% of the vote then. A lot has happened, though, since 2012. You think Southwest Virginia is ready for change?
You know, I do think so, John, and it's an uphill struggle. I won't go into too many of our campaign details, but I'll tell you a few things about what I think has changed and how we're trying to tap into that. So first off, when I ran in 2012, the 39%, which to me sounds like a pretty good ass whipping, was still nevertheless actually a pretty good number compared to how Democrats have done since then. And we also only entered that race the spring before the election in March, really didn't get rolling till May. This time I entered back in October, and one of the things that's allowed me to do is to just get around the 9th District much, much more comprehensively than I did before. The 9th District of Virginia geographically is slightly larger than the state of New Jersey. It has 22 counties and 4 independent municipalities, so it's enormous. We committed to doing 100 town hall meetings during my campaign. We've done 56 so far. And what I'm hearing at these town halls, I just last night was in Buchanan County and Dickinson County, Virginia, which are both in the heart of the Appalachian coalfields. What I'm hearing is, first of all, a lot of people have given up on both parties. A lot of people are incredibly frustrated that rural communities and working people's concerns, whether they're farmers or coal miners or school teachers or many other occupations, a lot of people feel like neither party has done them very well. So when liberals will say, why do those people vote against their interests? I'm sort of generally saying back, well, exactly who would they have voted for that had their interests? Because although I'm absolutely no fan of where the Republican Party is at the top or even in the middle, I think they've gone off the deep end. Nevertheless, I think the Democratic Party has not been a sufficiently clear, strong alternative for working people, and particularly in rural districts like the 9th. And the basic analysis is the rich and the powerful already have tons of friends in Congress. Those people call the shots. The biggest corporations and the wealthiest people and their donors and their lobbyists, they write the rules. They write the legislation, whether it's about banking and finance, whether it's about agricultural policy, whether it's economic development, whatever, pharmaceuticals, they write the rules. And people across the spectrum are sick of that. And I'm sick of it. So I find a really quite a strong reception to the idea that not only do we need bottom-up economics, but we need representatives who are working people themselves.
Do you think one of the changes to this might be campaign finance reform? I'm guessing the Koch brothers are not funding your campaign.
You know, John, I've been sending them email after email, but I just can't seem to get them to respond. No, they're not funding. And in fact, from the beginning, we have said we will take no corporate contribution. So we're not getting funded by the Koch brothers, by Big Pharma, by the NRA, anybody. Ours is a grassroots campaign. We are building a base of thousands of small donors. That's what we have to do because we have to raise a lot of money. But yeah, campaign finance reform is one of the issues that has incredibly strong support across the political spectrum, and yet is one of the most difficult ones to move at a legislative level. And that's just proof of how our many, not all, but so many of our congresspeople, senators, and certainly the president are in thrall with the donor class. I would love to see and would work towards overthrowing Citizens United. But the truth is, even before Citizens United, we had still basically given away our politics to the rich and the powerful, to the biggest corporations. Citizens United was just kind of confirmation of what had been developing for many years. So I think we need to do that, but I also think we need to pass vigorous and real public financing laws. One interesting proposal that's been floating out there is that every American citizen of voting age would get a voucher for each political cycle. And different amounts have been talked about, but $50 or $100 of money. And it would be ours to choose which candidates we give our voucher to. Now, that may not sound like a lot, but when you do the math, for instance, in the 9th District of Virginia, there's about 450,000 registered voters. If they each had $100 to use for the congresspeople, senators, and president of their choice, that comes out to being $45 million that would be available to fund campaigns. That's a lot of money, a lot more than I'm going to raise on my own. So whether it's the voucher system, whether it's direct funding, I think there's a very strong and broadly based clamoring for real campaign finance reform, including the funding of elections and keeping lobbyists from the revolving door where they move right from being elected officials or senior staff into the industries that they were supposed to be managing and monitoring before.
I'm speaking with Anthony Flaccavento on Progressive Spirit. He's the author of the 2017 book, Building a Healthy Economy from the Bottom Up, Harnessing Real-World Experience for Transformative Change, now running for Congress. In 2017, you launched a website called Rural Progressive Politics, and people might automatically think rural and progressive. Do they go together? You just talked just a few minutes ago, and you've said in other places that Republicans and Democrats throw farmers, labor under the bus. What's your vision for rural and progressive?
Yeah, it's really incredible when you think that that has become, in most people's minds, an oxymoron, because in central Appalachia, in Kansas, in many rural places, it wasn't that many years ago that there was a very strong progressive movement in rural areas. It was a progressive movement focused on bread and butter issues, and one that said fundamentally, the role of government is not to enable the rich to become richer, the most powerful to become even more powerful. The role of government was to level the playing field. The role of government was to protect and enable average, everyday people, working folks, to have a fair shot at things. That's kind of what defined the early decades of the progressive movement, and it was very popular in many rural areas. Now, things have changed. We recognize that, but part of our effort, I gathered with a group of about a dozen people shortly after Trump's election, and we started working on this rural progressive platform, and that's what we published and is on our website that you mentioned, Rural Progressive Politics. It's a very short, simple 4-page document, and what it does is it tries to give voice to progressive values and policies, but in a rural context. So a couple ways that that differentiates other progressive things. Number one, it recognizes that in rural communities, a lot more people, a lot higher percentage, I should say, of people live very close to the land, but don't necessarily consider themselves to be environmentalists. We're at this terrible irony that so many farmers, so many fishermen and hunters, so many loggers and others that in fact depend on a healthy ecosystem have come to hate environmentalists, the environmental movement, the EPA. Now, a big chunk of that, those sentiments, of course, are what people like Donald Trump have done, and before him, many others, and Fox News, that have sort of created this persuasive narrative that anybody who's liberal or anybody who's from a city is against your interests. And that's been a chunk of it. But the other thing I believe is that those of us that would consider ourselves to be progressives and environmentalists, we've also played into that as well by too often not making it clear that the welfare of the people in rural communities, those farmers, those fishermen, those loggers and others, is just as important as protecting the ecosystem. We've too often put the environmental protection out there first, second, and third, and you got to go down the list before you find, well, what are we going to do to these folks whose livelihoods we're impacting? So our rural progressive platform starts with that recognition that we need to figure out how to make partners of people who actually live day in and day out much closer to the land than most urban and suburban environmentalists do. And I think there's real ways to do that by investing in sustainable farming, sustainable forestry, sustainable fisheries, all of that stuff, making partners of the people who bring us our food, our fiber, and our energy instead of making enemies out of them. So that's one piece of a rural progressive platform that talks about land, labor, and community. I think we have to do that.
I do want to take a different direction here. Think about war, issues of war and peace, ongoing wars in the Middle East, saber rattling all over. Is the empire building and warmongering also a result of corporations know best mindset? I mean, that's my thought. I was wondering if you might comment on that.
Well, I think it's a lot of different things. I think certainly the military-industrial complex, as Eisenhower called it so many years ago, is alive and well. I think it's been augmented and expanded by the privatization of many different functions that our armed services used to do, essentially public employees. Now, with so many of those functions contracted out, that furthers the reach and the grip of the military-industrial complex. So I think that's absolutely critical. I also think, though, that it's a cultural problem we have. I think that we as Americans have really lost sight of why many people in many parts of the country, they may love elements of America, but they also have come to either fear us or to really revile certain parts of it because they don't feel that we are there for their best interests. They feel that many of our entanglements, and I share this view, overseas, are driven more by either profits or access to resources. Imagine a world in which we could downsize our military dramatically. Well, to do that, we would have to be contributing to stability, to democracy, and to prosperity in the rest of the world. The fact of the matter is, much of humanity struggles. There's a lot of suffering, and there's plenty of bad guys out there that want to step into those problems, whether it's ISIS or Al-Qaeda or Al-Shabaab or whatever. Those are the current bad guys. But there's always been those folks who will step into chaos, step into suffering, and offer an alternative. What if we emphasize real bottom-up development, really empowering other nations, regions, and communities to develop and build their own prosperity, their own self-reliance, and with that, their own political institutions, whatever shape they took, to take care of themselves. If that's where our money went, it might take a generation, but I believe that the justification and the need for big military expenditure, defensive expenditures, would drop dramatically to the degree that we help other nations just build better economies and communities themselves. And I don't think we do nearly enough of that now. We only seem to want to do nation building in the aftermath of a conflict or a war that we've initiated, rather than trying to just help communities for their own for moral reasons, but also for our own self-interest. Because if more of the world was prosperous and stable, we would be sending a lot fewer of our soldiers into conflict.
If there were two or three public policy changes that could be made at the national level, at the congressional level, that could make the most difference, that is, remove the barriers to building a healthy bottom-up economy for all Americans, what would you say are two or three most important public policy changes that should be made?
I'll give you three, John, at different levels. For one, and this would be a policy change that would be both federal, state, and local, but it would be to move away from subsidizing larger outside corporations. I'm not saying you never do it, but move away from putting most of our economic development dollars into recruiting big boxes or recruiting big industries to come to a community, because that's a kind of a zero-sum game. Mostly it's not new business activity. sometimes it is, but mostly it's taking an existing business from another place by offering them big subsidies. If instead those economic development subsidies were focused on local infrastructure, local schools and training and retraining, and local small to mid-sized businesses, farms, and manufacturers, I think the total economic impact would be both much greater and much more lasting, because too often when we do a sweet deal with the company, they come in, we've seen it over and over in Southwest Virginia and Appalachia, they stick around for a while and then they go to greener pasture. So I think first thing is shift our economic development expenditures from a focus on recruiting big businesses, big boxes, to building the diverse local economies. Second one, I'm convinced that we need a national infrastructure bank. This would be funded by not taxpayer dollars, but bonds, people taking out bonds, a bank that, some people believe could be capitalized at $2 to $3 trillion initially. That infrastructure bank could then fund broadband. It could fund basic infrastructure we need for a new grid to be able to accommodate renewable energy. It could fund, of course, water and sewer, value-adding infrastructure for farms, and forests, and fisheries, all kinds of things, but we need an infrastructure bank. And then the third one I'd say is we've got to revitalize and revive our antitrust legislation. We have basically stopped enforcing antitrust or anti-monopoly legislation, and that has enabled the biggest players to keep getting bigger. Again, whether they're bankers, whether they're pharmaceutical, whether they're health insurance, whether they're food and agriculture, the constant level of concentration throughout our economy is insane, and the media as well. And we need to revitalize and put some teeth into our antitrust. So those would be three that I think together could be transformative.
Final question for you, Anthony. Have you found other people like yourself taking on, going into politics, running on a platform of bottom-up economics in other parts of the country?
Yes, and I'm very excited that actually through the Rural Progressive Platform, several people reached out to me who themselves were congressional candidates, and I'll mention two. One is Emily Martz, who's running in upstate New York above the city in the Hudson Valley area. She's doing an excellent campaign there, and another is Jess King, who just won her primary in Eastern Pennsylvania, near Philadelphia, but in the rural area surrounding it. Both of them are running Democrats who are running, at least in part, based on some of the values and policies in the Rural Progressive Platform. So together we've fantasized about the notion, if we all win, of forming a Rural Progressive Caucus in Congress to start changing the language and the game a little bit.
Anthony Flaccavento, he's the author of Building a Healthy Economy from the Bottom Up, Harnessing Real-World Experience for Transformative Change, running for Congress in the 9th District of Southwest Virginia on these platforms. Anthony, thanks for being with me today, and good luck.
Thanks so much, John. Really appreciate the opportunity.
This is Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. Next, I speak with Linda Kohanov. We'll talk about how those who understand horses understand humans. Linda Kohanov is the author of The Five Roles of the Master Herder, a revolutionary model for socially intelligent leadership. Stay with us. Progressive Spirit is produced every week. It couldn't happen without the financial support of my congregation, Southminster Presbyterian Church in Beaverton, Oregon. Southminster's website is www.southmin.org. Progressive Spirit is produced in the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, for the Pacifica Radio Network, and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, as well as podcast. Show KBOO some love, won't you? KBOO.fm, and click donate. You're listening to Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. Linda Kohanov is the author of the bestseller, The Tao of Equus. She teaches and speaks internationally. She established EponiQuest worldwide to explore the healing potential of working with horses and offer programs on everything from emotional and social intelligence, leadership, stress reduction, and parenting, to consensus building and mindfulness. We'll talk about her latest book, The Five Roles of a Master Herder, a Revolutionary Model for Socially Intelligent Leadership. Via Skype from Armado, Arizona. Welcome, Linda, to Progressive Spirit.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Tell me about The Five Roles of a Master Herder. How did this book come to be?
It started when I was researching the history of leadership in multiple cultures across time for my fourth book, The Power of the Herd. And I found that a specific kind of lifestyle that you can see on multiple continents and in multiple religions, as a matter of fact, it's a lifestyle called nomadic pastoralism. These are tribes that migrate with large animals, and they employ this amazing, socially intelligent form of herd management that allows interspecies communities to move across vast landscapes. These people have to deal with predators and changing climates. They have to protect and nurture the group while keeping these massive, sometimes aggressive horses and cattle together. And here's the key. They do this all without the benefit of fences and with very little reliance on restraints. And I began to see that they knew something about keeping free, empowered groups together. And this is more important than ever. People have more freedom than they've ever had before. And so the old dominance submission paradigms of top-down leadership are actually becoming more problematic when you have, you know, neglectful or heavy-handed managers alienating their most gifted staff members. These are the ones who can really help a company, a nonprofit, or a community organization shine. And so your most confident, talented employees might do something more infuriating than just quit if you offend them. They might actually become your competition. These days, anyone with a great idea can raise money online. They can order supplies delivered to the door. And Apple Computers is a great example of someone who conceived a multi-million dollar corporation in the corner of a basement or garage. So I think that now more than ever, we need sophisticated leadership skills to attract and keep our most inventive, empowered people on board, whatever kind of organization we're running.
And kind of the irony about this is that the leadership needed for an emerging social and technological area is actually going back to a pre-agricultural civilization and so forth, in some respect, isn't it? Or back to this pastoral model of leadership.
Yes. Yes. It's really quite amazing because, you know, to keep these animals together, and you have to develop trust and you have to bond with them, but they're also very powerful and dangerous. So you have to be able to stand up to aggressive youngsters, and you have to do it in such a way that you actually help them socialize their incredible power. And I can see, you know, with a lot of people running amok these days in various ways, a lot of people don't know how to manage their power. And so we don't have to reinvent the wheel, as it turns out. We just have to go back. You know, when you have this phenomenon of what I call the master herder, it's a term I use to describe a strong, compassionate, well-balanced leader who also acts as a caretaker and a guardian. You know, we're familiar with these roles too, but we tend to over-specialize. So these roles are the leader, the dominant, the nurturer companion, the sentinel, and the predator. And by expertly juggling these skills, managers of large animals, they can moderate power plays, they can nurture individual talents, and they can keep the group together during droughts and wars, as well as during times of peace and prosperity.
Did you grow up with horses?
No, I didn't. I loved horses like many young girls do, but my parents were afraid of them. So it wasn't until I was in my 30s and I was a manager of different radio stations and music festivals. That was my original career, was as a music critic and radio announcer and producer, and then got promoted into different kinds of management positions. And what I found was that people were absolutely driving me crazy. And so I decided to buy a horse to get away from the craziness of the human race on a regular basis. But what happened instead was that I began to see that the horse was actually tuning me to become a more balanced and more effective and more assertive leader, and also allowed me to lead up. In other words, one of the first experiences I had after I had been working with a horse and learning how to, you know, achieve respect and a kind of bonding and trust at the same time, was I had a very aggressive boss who was kind of trying to push me around. And I used some of the same techniques that I used with horses to work with him. And he backed off. He became more respectful and actually warmed up to me. It was a very strange thing to see in action. But I was like, wow, you know, somebody should like take people out to work with horses to learn, you know, leadership skills and parenting skills and relationship skills. And this was in the 1990s. And a lot of people thought I was a little bit out there to say, you know, well, I'm less interested in training horses than in what horses have to teach people. And now it's a pretty common thing. There's equine facilitated learning and leadership training all over the world. And my organization, EponaQuest Worldwide, has, I think at this point, over 300 instructors internationally who can take this work to various communities and not just businesses, but also we work with spiritual communities. We also work with parents. And when we work in collaboration with a mental health professional, we also work with survivors of extreme experiences, rape, sexual abuse, physical abuse. And the horses are just so incredibly effective at teaching people how to become more balanced and more empowered while also considerate of others.
You know, you'd think a pushback that someone might offer is, well, human beings and their behaviors are so different from horses, but really, actually, we have far more in common, perhaps, than difference. Is that right? And a lot of course, interaction that you talk about is really nonverbal. Can you explain some more of that, of how that communication comes across and how horses can help us identify the ways we communicate?
Even among humans, they've done some studies in the 1990s, and psychologists determined that only about 10% of human communication is verbal. So that leaves 90% of the messages that we send back and forth to each other in that nonverbal range. And horses are masters of nonverbal communication in part because they're not predators. In nature, they can be preyed upon, but they're also very powerful. And it's when they work together, that's why I called my fourth book, The Power of the Herd. When they work together, actually, they can drive off lions and wolves and other predators. Around here, we have coyotes, and horses are not at all afraid of coyotes, the ones that I have. They just kind of laugh and chase them around for sport. So a horse is an herbivore, a non-predator, but the horse is not a victim. And this is very, very inspiring to some of the rape and abuse survivors that I've worked with in collaboration with different mental health professionals, too, a lot of times when somebody's been victimized by another human, they do not want to accept personal growth that leads them into power because they're afraid they're going to become like the predator that preyed on them. And so the horse becomes this amazing teacher of non-predatory power. And humans actually are omnivores. We have the teeth of a vegetarian and our eyes are forward like lions and wolves. And so we have these kind of Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde moments where sometimes the predatory aspect of us takes over and is highly influential in our current culture. I mean, our current culture is actually a conquest-oriented culture. That's how we got to the United States, you know, through conquest. Mm. And this is a dominant submission paradigm. And so it's a highly predatory mentality. And you see that a lot in business still and in politics. Politics is a highly predatory system. And you can learn how to stand up to predators in constructive ways by learning behaviors from horses that humans can easily adopt.
If you are just joining us on Progressive Spirit, I'm speaking with Linda Kohanov. She is the author of The Five Roles of a Master Herder, a Revolutionary Model for Socially Intelligent Leadership. So let's talk more about that predatory, non-predatory. That seems to be kind of the part of the key to this. Can you describe more what predatory behavior is versus non-predatory?
Sure. Here's one of the key aspects. Have you ever been part of a group where somebody said, I don't feel safe in the group?
Oh, yeah, sure, that happens quite a bit.
And so this is one of the key pieces, is that when you don't feel safe in a group, there is a sense that you understand that there's a predatory factor in that particular group. It could be an individual, or it could be that the business or group is being run in a predatory manner. And one of the primary non-lethal characteristics of predatory behavior is to seek out and use others' vulnerabilities against them for personal gain, so that it's very hard to make a mistake or admit that you need additional training or, you know, make an interpersonal mistake even, that you have this sense that if that happens, somebody's going to jump in and, whether overtly or behind your back, use that against you for their personal gain. And that's a primary characteristic of our predatory social system. So even in higher education has a highly predatory orientation. If you present a paper at a conference, everybody in there is pretty much sitting there waiting for you to make some minor mistake so they can jump on you and discredit you. And I've worked with some people who have PhDs and are very successful in their fields, but they have been traumatized by that and they have trouble trusting people. So one of the primary characteristics of a non-predatory power system is that vulnerable individuals can rely on others. So horses will protect vulnerable herd members. Some horses are more competitive than others. Like I said, it's a continuum. But it is the nature of predators to sort of slink around and wait for the weakest, most vulnerable herd member to walk away from the herd. Like I said, lions and wolves don't attack adult herd members, especially when they're in groups, because they can be killed. So what they do is they're sneaky. They hide in the grass, they wait for the most vulnerable herd member, and then they attack. And that's kind of what people do in a metaphorical sense to each other a lot. When you don't feel safe in a group, what you really sense is that somebody in the group is likely to use a vulnerability against you.
So these characteristics, these five roles of a master herder, wouldn't necessarily be for the leader of a group. These are skills for anyone engaged in human connection. Am I right? So let's talk about some of these roles. There's the dominant and then there's the leader. What's the difference between those two?
This is one of the most interesting aspects of the research that I did into these cultures that was the most enlightening for me, was that they know very consciously that among herds of large herbivores like horses and cattle and zebras, the leader animals and the dominant animals are often two different animals, and they actually perform different functions that lead to the health of the entire social system. And so these master herders, as I call them, and I use this not in terms of master slave, I use it in terms of mastery of five roles and a kind of self-mastery of your own power. And so these master herders know when to use the leader role and when to use the dominant role and what the functions are. And so a leader is an animal that calms and focuses others during intense or novel situations. A dominant animal is one that has a kind of divisive power and a driving power. So a dominant animal will break up fights between two animals. You have to use that divisive power to do that. And then they'll drive the herd from behind. You see the stallion driving the herd from behind. That's a dominant animal. A leader, on the other hand, is out front and is actually leading the others toward food or water or, you know, the leader is often set apart from the others because of their unusual confidence and curiosity. They, among domesticated horses, a lot of times it's even hard to tell who the leader is or who has leadership potential, because leaders most often show up in a novel situation and they show appropriate caution, but then they move toward the new thing and check it out. And then their confidence and curiosity becomes contagious to others. And over time, they add life experience to that. So that when something new happens in the environment, after a while, the other herd members look to that leader and see if a lion is walking by, is the leader really nervous and running off? Well, then they run off. But herbivores can tell the difference between a lion that's on the prowl and one that's just kind of wandering through. And so if a lion is wandering through, the other horses will look to the leader, and the leader will just kind of, you know, check it out for a moment and then go back to grazing. And so they'll conserve energy for true emergencies. They don't run automatically at the sight of a predator. With a dominant, on the other hand, dominants are very skeptical of anything new. And so the dominant, if it sees a lion, is likely to try to herd everybody away from the lion. But the dominant is also really powerful. So the dominant animals can work together and also even separately to be highly intimidating enough to drive off a predator. And so the dominant role is it has a directive power, a divisive power, a driving power, it's a kind of a pushing power, and then it's highly protective. Whereas the leader is kind of a visionary. And so, you know, among human visionaries, you know, it becomes clear that creativity and innovation become a part of that. So it's important for us to learn when to use the dominant role and when to use the leader role. And these two forms of power are very active. Whereas the thing that keeps the dominant and leader roles, the power of those roles in balance, are people who have also access to the nurturer companion role, which is the role that is supportive, that is connective, that builds trust, that holds the herd and the tribe together. And then there is also the sentinel role, when you think of shepherds guarding their sheep, that's somebody who's engaging the sentinel role. And in our culture, a lot of times we have people specialize in that role, but we all need to learn to use it properly and learn how to trade it, because we think of the sentinel role as in the realm of law enforcement. In law enforcement, they are specifically trained to engage the sentinel role and the dominant role, and hopefully they are not using the predator role. Because you can use the dominant role to be protective and to drive off predators and to herd others away from danger and break up fights without adding predatory power to it. When you combine the predator role with the dominant role, it becomes very aggressive and very dangerous, but you don't need predatory power to use the dominant role. So that's kind of an overview.
Linda Kahanov is my guest, The Five Roles of a Master Herder, a Revolutionary Model for Socially Intelligent Leadership. This is Progressive Spirit. So can you talk a little bit, give us some examples of perhaps when being a nurturer is better than the leadership one in a specific situation or something like that?
Absolutely. The point I'm making with this book and what I learned from these nomadic pastoral cultures is that to over-specialize in any one of the roles is to bring out a dysfunctional side of that role. So dominants tend to be overtly intimidating. If you overemphasize that role or use it in its immature form, and I mean, you can be 75 years old and use the dominant role in its immature form. They tend to have a strong sense of entitlement. They can be overly aggressive. They also do this really odd thing where they and dominant horses will do this too when they're also immature dominants, is that they'll attack others for little or no reason. And this seems abusive to everybody else, but to a dominant human or animal, it makes sense, because what they're trying to do is keep everybody a little off balance, and they perceive that they have more control that way, but it's really only short-term control. It's not control in novel situations. And so as a result, immature dominant people and animals will try to reinforce the status quo because they have more control there. The nurturer companion role is something that's very important even in business. It is the great connecting role. And if you're going to be useful in that role, you have to have a mature use of the nurturer companion role too. And so I can give you an example of how it shows up in business. Basically, we had a man by the name of Greg Reed, who I interviewed and got in contact with, and he's a sociometrist. And so he's brought in by large corporations to measure and help them learn how to function better in terms of communication flow and productivity. And he was brought in by a major software company. They had two major problems they wanted him to deal with. One, they said, was a group of programmers they called the curmudgeons. And you can kind of imagine who those people were, right? They're the people who kind of, you know, stick to themselves. They're high producers, but they really are not that socially adept, right?
Right.
And then the other problem they mentioned was a woman by the name of Melanie. And they were really distressed about Melanie. She was a program director, or not a program director. She was a programmer at this place. And her productivity measures were low. And every time they tried to get her to up her productivity, there was no response. And they were upset. They were asking, well, why don't you just fire Melanie? And they said, well, the problem is that everybody loves Melanie, so including us in HR. So if we fire her, it's going to be pretty traumatic. So in some sense, they were asking Greg Reed to fire her for them. But what happened was when Greg Reed took measurements of communication flow and productivity in the company, he found that when the average person went on vacation, there was about a 5% drop in productivity. And when Melanie went on vacation, there was a 37% drop in productivity across the board. Hmm. What happened was is that Melanie was the great connector of the company. She, when people were new to the company, she welcomed them. She helped them understand where to go and who to see. If somebody didn't know what they needed, they would go see Melanie, and Melanie knew where to direct them. And so one of the things that Greg said was that, you know, Melanie could speak geek and regular English. And so she was even like a translator between the curmudgeons and the sales staff. And so she was performing the nurturer companion role in its mature form in a business setting, and they had no way to measure this. They weren't even noticing how important she was. And basically, she didn't have time to do her job and raise her productivity measures in programming because she was performing another role that no one was even recognizing. And had they fired Melanie, they would have lost everything that she knew and her ability to connect. They would have had probably a permanent 37% drop in productivity, and it would have taken them a long time to recover.
My guest has been Linda Kohanov. She's the author of The Five Roles of a Master Herder, a Revolutionary Model for Socially Intelligent Leadership. Thank you so much for this book and for spending time with me today.
Thank you, John. It was a real pleasure.
Progressive Spirit is heard each week. On Progressive Spirit, you hear interviews with cutting-edge scholars, authors, and activists who have something to say about social justice, human flourishing, and things that matter. You can download Progressive Spirit for free on your favorite podcast app. The website is progressivespirit.net. Follow also on Facebook and Twitter. Progressive Spirit is produced in the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon. I'm John Schuck. Be well.